This is Mark Seltzer.
And Jessica Piclo.
Today we're going to take a look at the goings-on in Copenhagen.
Yeah, interesting and contentious.
Yeah, today it seemed to be about protests and a lot of protests in the streets and police turning back protests in the streets. So it's interesting how, you know, maybe that's just my perception from here in the news, but there's this glow of the different interests asserting themselves.
I would hope, although I haven't seen that play out, that there would be a baseline understanding that we share the same interest ultimately, and that is coming up with some solution to curbing climate change to the extent that humans have manipulated and exacerbated that, and to find a way to move forward in technology and development that are not mutually exclusive and damaging to our planet.
But you're right. I mean, this really is the premise of it. It's a very noble effort. It's an incredible event, a world conference to take on a world problem. Mm-hmm. So there's this incredible goal, very ambitious goal, especially in the sense that there have not been worldwide agreements to achieve things on this kind of a scale before. And yet there is a lot of uncertainty, different nations bringing different interests. Also, even the issue within the United States about whether Obama will be able to bring Congress along with his vision of committing the United States to these goals.
Mm-hmm. They certainly raise a lot of interesting questions, particularly as we witness either a restructuring or a possible restructuring of global economic power. One thing that the divide in the climate debate has illustrated is that for those nations who hit industrialization early, there was a significant financial benefit to that. And we see now other nations saying we should not be penalized by both your pollution and our lagging behind in terms of industrial development. And that so in terms of how that plays out in an ultimate deal, I think will be very interesting. And what effect, if any, the outside protesters will have on the process or even the appearance of the politicalization going on inside the process.
Yeah. And the developing nations are looking at it as their right to follow that same course. And yet we know that if everyone in China, everyone in India buys a car and runs a car as the same way everyone in the United States has over the last 50 years, that it would be, a catastrophe for at least the way we see it now in terms of using fossil fuels, contributing to greenhouse gas problems. So very interesting moral question. In terms of the use of resources, and then the political question, who's got the power? Will the developed nations be able to force the developing nations into an agreement, or will developing nations resist?
I feel like the events on the ground have changed so rapidly on a daily basis that I don't have my arms around even the beginnings of a prediction onto how that will all shake out. And then, as you pointed out, even if there is ultimately an agreement, what, if anything, does that mean in terms of President Obama's ability to get Congress to follow along with it and craft legislation that gets us to that goal? And if we don't, then what's the political cost, both domestically and internationally, for failure to get that kind of consensus?
I've been looking at sort of a best case scenario for the Obama administration, thinking that the administration goes to Denmark, makes a bold, ambitious commitment for the United States along the lines of what the House of Representatives already passed in terms of a cap and trade bill, commitments to scale back our production, our use of greenhouse gases, emission of greenhouse gases, mm-hmm. and that the Senate would be encouraged, especially with a very substantial Democratic majority in the Senate, to pass similar legislation. And I think there really is a possibility of that. But it's not certain, and that's just an optimistic goal. And if the developing nations pull out of the climate talks and refuse to agree, then I think that the Senate will lose its impetus. So there's also this kind of back and forth between the developed nations and the developing nations, between the United States and other nations, because I don't think the Senate is going to be willing to commit if others haven't made a commitment, and yet no one is going to want to commit if the United States, one of the leading industrial powers and most responsible powers for the emissions so far, isn't able to commit.
And as we've seen with the healthcare debate, there is just no telling what the Senate is going to do on anything.
Yeah, right. And it may very well following in the spirit of the healthcare debate come down to massaging single votes and working with subtle differences to get 60 on board in order to open debate and to close debate and do everything else that's needed. I think.
Go on.
I was just going to say, you had mentioned the protests in Copenhagen. I've been watching those with interest, but I feel that a lot of the protests are out of the realistic arena of what is contemplated for an agreement. So maybe they're drumming up support for the movement to attack climate change, or they are rallying the troops against industrial nations for their wrongs. You know, I'm not sure exactly, but what the protests don't seem to be doing is supporting an agreement along the lines of what's really being contemplated. So I just wonder how effective they will be at supporting this first step of global international, you know, cooperation with the United States participating. Kyoto was certainly an important step, but the U.S. refused to participate, and there's a much better opportunity here.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think that what we're really seeing is how much crafting policy on a large scale is really an exercise in herding cats, because you are never going to have all of the cats in one place at one time. And so the best you can do, I guess, is get some sort of close to majority and appreciate that you will leave a significant amount of the population upset on both sides of the issue. Yeah. Which, if we get something like that out of Copenhagen, I think would be a victory, because quite frankly, we need something. And I think that the one thing that President Obama has done a good job of consistently reminding people is that many of these issues have been avoided from a long-term policy solution for far too long. They've existed and we've just chosen not to deal with them. And we are hopefully at the point where we can still act rather than react.
Yeah. You know, that's right. There seems to have been some joking about the Obama administration in terms of, you know, how much it's accomplished. And certainly Republicans are apt to be saying, you know, that either his plans are too ambitious, for example, with health care, or that he hasn't actually accomplished anything, somehow referring to economic policy or unemployment. But I think that completely misses what's really going on, maybe just wishful thinking in the Republican agenda. But the Obama administration has been ambitious, and it's put out its ambitious goals. It has a lot of people working on them. They're not waiting for Obama's time to move these different things forward on healthcare, on Copenhagen, on Afghanistan. I mean, the major policy initiatives are moving forward, and Senator Lieberman notwithstanding in terms of healthcare this week, I think that we're very close to substantial accomplishments in these different areas. So, you know, I think we're going to look back at this first year and find that a lot was accomplished. You know, facts may prove me wrong, but, and they obviously have to solve the Lieberman problem in order to get him on board and pass health care in the Senate.
Yeah, how do we solve a problem like Lieberman? I mean, it's kind of a cheesy play on The Sound of Music, but it's true. He has really become a thorn in the side of the administration. And I think you bring up a great point, which is, you know, history will judge that there has been a lot accomplished. And it's been interesting for me to hear from both the progressives and the right this argument that the president is now not out in front on the issue of healthcare, for example, and really taking the charge in crafting legislation. When we saw in the Clinton administration what that created. And I think that there's a specific tactical reason why we don't see more of that. But it also ignores the fact that that's not the president's job. That's Congress's job. And they are the people who write legislation, and he sets policy, and they are, in the best case scenario, there to move those policy directives forward. Whether or not they've done a good job of that, I don't know. What remains to be seen is what gets passed. But, you know, Lieberman, he had a powerful ally in the president. He still has some significant chairmanship seats that he has been able to hold on to. Specifically, my understanding is because the president said, let's not yank him from it. We are not going to punish him for siding with the enemy, so to speak, in the last election. Let's prove that we have bipartisan interests at heart and move forward. And now we see one person who caucuses with the Democrats and used to consider himself a Democrat siding with some very conservative positions in the healthcare debate, and for no real good reason that I've been able to discern.
Well, I think it's a very interesting political question that the Democrats have to solve. They need 60 votes in order to close debate and bring this legislation, you know, back to a conference to reconcile it with the House legislation that's already been passed. So they have to reach 60. It's possible they could get Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, the senators from Maine, in order to go around Lieberman. But what I noticed the other day when Harry Reid put together a compromise or submitted a compromise to the CBO for scoring that contained an expansion of Medicare and jettisoning the public option. Public option was that Lieberman came out and said, I will not support this. This will not fly. And pretty quickly, Harry Reid said, well, we're going to get people back together. And I think Obama did this too, and say, we're going to get people get back together and find something that they do agree on. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed to me that Lieberman turned around and said, I like most everything else in the bill. This is good legislation. I just want to support it with this way. So even though it seems like he is being destructive, I have a feeling that Obama feels that the bulk of this bill is done, that it is good as it is, that the public option is not as significant as people give it, you know, time and credit to be, and that he just wants to take what he's already got and move it forward, maybe moving it forward into the conference committee where it's going to change again. So I don't know. I have I'm not sure if that's clear, but I have mixed feelings about what it is that Lieberman's really doing and, you know, and why Obama is going forward on this. You know, they may be more concerned with the abortion funding issue. It may be that there's going to be compromises where they're able to say, look, there's no public option. You're going to have to drop the Stupak Amendment idea, some of those things. I don't know. But they sure let Lieberman take his position rather than trying to force him to change.
It's a real interesting pickle that the Obama administration finds themselves in, because as you can imagine, the progressive community is not at all pleased with these latest developments. And there's a lot of rumblings about not supporting the bill as a result of it, that we have caved to the demands of somebody who, quite frankly, is not really a supporter of Democratic ideals and Democratic policy options. So rather than pass a bad bill that in some would argue is a significant giveaway to the insurance industry without too much of a benefit to the public, we should kill the bill. And I mean, we heard Howard Dean say that as of yesterday, and I know a lot of progressives who feel the same way. I'm torn on this idea. I think that we've come 50 years without any significant healthcare reform, and we need something. And I want to make sure that we have the kind of consumer protections like the inability to discriminate against people because of pre-existing conditions and forcing insurance companies to use 90% of the premium dollars they collect to provide for services rather than profit board members and directors and officers. So part of me says, well, even a not perfect bill, even a weak bill is a place to start to add from. But I got to tell you, I don't know. Without the ability to really put the screws to the insurance company, I think we have seen that they have zero interest in debating this issue in good faith and in acknowledging that there is a moral obligation, a moral component to it. We still as a country haven't answered that question of, do we think that people have a right by virtue of their citizenship or their status as persons in this country to not be discriminated against in access to affordable healthcare services? We've punted on that issue. And I think those roosters are coming home now, and I don't know how it's going to shake out.
Yeah.
I know that that there are a lot of progressives saying that they are not supporting this bill. So we may have gained one at the expense of 10, you know, at least in the House. We'll see where that goes. Yeah. You know, there, Sherrod Brown was putting on a good face and saying that this is a good bill. It does some good things for consumers. If there are any more compromises, though, I think we'll see even level-headed progressives like Senator Brown off the table.
Well, that may be. I think that, you know, again, it comes down to like the central core of the bill is still expanding in the direction of universal coverage. So it depends what had to be given up in order to do that. And I don't know that we would say that we've given, I mean, I guess one could say that the insurance companies have gained more participants. Mm-hmm. So they've expanded their market.
Right. The mandate certainly does that with no countervailing competitive force to prevent insurers from passing on the added expense that the other coverage mandates require also.
Right. Right. Yeah. I can see it. I understand, I still feel that the president's goal of expanding towards universal coverage is the primary issue, and that the legislation is going to work in that direction, and therefore it seems that it would still get support. But I understand that the more you peel back the various benefits, the more likely you are to lose progressives who have been supporting change all along and legislation all along to expand healthcare, but might feel that it's not workable. But boy, that would be an awfully hard decision to make after this many, years of other types of failures, to think that something better is going to come along in the next 10 or 20 years could be a risky bet.
And I think that's the ultimate political calculus that many are doing right now, which is, and it's what I'm doing in terms of deciding my own personal support for the bill or not. Can I get behind a bill that I feel is significantly flawed because it at least represents a step in the right direction? And it is always easier to amend legislation than pass legislation. So, I think I might be leaning towards don't kill the bill. That said, if I had dislike and distrust for the insurance industry before this process started, it has only exacerbated.
Well, I think why don't we'll leave it there. We're not going to solve it today, and we can pick it up again next week.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks, Jessica.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Mark. Bye.